This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is indeed the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as we always are at this time. And today's guest, it's a real pleasure to have today's guest, and a delight and an honor, in fact, Johnny Steinberg. He's the author of a whole variety of books on the South Africa as it changed, as it became what it is now, the good, the bad, the less than pleasant, but with human insights. I think I first read your book about Natal Midlands, which was a kind of a horrific wake-up call, really, about how one killing spiraled into something else, and then that led to yet other things, and the cycle of violence went on and on. And two of his books, actually, Midlands, the one I'm talking about, and a book about The Number, which is about a prison gangster, both of those have been award winners. And Johnny was, he was a Wits University student. Then he went to Oxford in Britain, obviously, where he was a Rhodes Scholar, and has a doctorate in political theory, which I think infuses the way he describes events and people in this country, although there's a touch of drama and theater in what he writes, too. Did you take any courses in theater?
No, I didn't.
But you went to theater, so you had a sense for it. Okay.
Yeah.
For years, he had a column that was highly regarded in Business Day. It says here he's written scripts for television drama. I'm afraid to ask which one.
It's a long time ago.
Okay. And you were even a consultant to the South African government on criminal justice policy.
Also a long time ago.
A long time ago. Well, we're all getting older. What can I say? And he was a professor of African studies at Oxford, and now he's currently lecturing part-time at the Council on African Studies at Yale University. But spends time in South Africa too, obviously. No, don't cut the connection.
No.
Now, his newest book, the reason why we're talking at all today, is called Winnie and Nelson, Portrait of a Marriage. But actually, it's rather more than just a portrait of a marriage. It's a portrait of a marriage of two people to a country and to the ideas they jointly and severally came together to hold and separately. In fact, and that's, I think, one of the main points in what you wrote. I wrote in my notes here that it was a conjoined political, psychological biography. That's probably making it a little too precious, but you had something like 150 interviews. But the part that startled me, because I didn't even realize it existed, it was an archive of transcribed, overheard, bugged conversations that was in an archive by Kobi Kutsia, who was then justice minister back in the late 80s and early 90s, I guess. And this whole archive has barely been exploited by any other historian. And that's interesting to me. Why people haven't just rushed to that collection of material and worked their way through it?
Well, I only discovered that it existed when I was halfway through this research. Just to fill listeners in, Kwebi Kutsia became Minister of Justice and Prisons in 1980 and immediately began bugging all of Nelson Mandela's visits, including with his wife, Winnie, and with his children. And those visits were either transcribed directly or they were summarized by warders. And by the time Nelson Mandela was released from prison, they were thousands of pages long. You know, everything Mandela had said to anybody as a prisoner had been written down and recorded. And when Kwebi Kutsia left office in 1994, he took all this documentation with him. He stole it.
I think that's the operative word there, isn't it?
It belonged to the state. It was top classified, top secret state
document.
It's a version of the same. And when his wife died in 2010 and his will was opened, the instruction in his will was that his documentation go to the Archive for Contemporary Affairs at the University of the Free State.
Free State, not the National Archive, not the Wits.
Legally, the documentation should have gone to the National Archive. And I discovered that it was there in 2019, and I contacted the archive, and to my astonishment discovered that although very few people knew that this documentation existed, it was open. You could just go and see it.
Now, you in the book, and this documentation obviously is a really core resource for you, but you put a parenthesis in there too, which says, remember, this is conversations of a prisoner who knew he was being taped most of the time.
Well, it's one resource among many because it, you know, the time period it covers is 1918 to 1990, and the book begins in the early 20th century. So, I mean, all sorts of sources in this book. But yes, for his relationship with Winnie and with his daughters and what's going on in his personal life during that 10-year period, it's a critical resource. And yes, they're difficult documents to interpret because they know that they're being recorded and nothing that they say is a transparent window onto their thoughts. And yet there are many occasions where what's happening between them is so intense, the stakes are so high, it is their only means of communicating with each other that they do at times forget that the bugs are there and pretty overwhelming stuff happens between them.
Well, I mean, I forget who it was who said it, but an autobiography is where the person writing about themselves always has the best lines and always has the right rejoinder to any comment and always gets the better in an argument or a discussion. But obviously this would not have been the case.
I mean, this is being eavesdropping onto life as it is lived, which is both a privilege for a biographer. It's not very often that that happens to a biographer, but it's also uncomfortable because it's a violation of a private space. These conversations were recorded because Nelson Mandela was a prisoner of the apartheid states. They were recorded against his will. And so I guess that I was always going to use them because I'm writing a book about a marriage and here they are. Here is the marriage in action. I guess I had a responsibility to use those documents carefully and to write about both people with the deepest possible sympathy and to do all in my power to preserve their dignity. I don't know if I got that right. That's for the readers to judge, not really for me.
I think so. I mean, I've read about 6 reviews now of the book and some people, they applauded your effort. They applauded the comprehensiveness and they scolded you gently for not being as scathing as you could have been in their opinion.
A scathing tone would have ruined the book. You know, these are two huge people and complicated people and there's a lot of darkness in both of these people. Both did some bad things. I mean, Winnie notoriously in the late 1980s is responsible for several deaths.
Yeah.
And to condemn her for that is easy and boring and not a challenge. I wanted rather to paint a completely unflinching portrait, but non-judgmental portrait. Wanted to be honest, but not judgmental. I mean, being judgmental it's not the difficult thing to do. It's the easy thing to do.
And yet at the same time, it seems to me, now this is a comment a friend of mine in Washington who had served in South Africa with me several times. He said, are you telling me that the era of hagiography on Nelson Mandela is now officially over? And I said, why? He said, well, all the books you've told me to look at are all books which are busy picking apart the legend in some way, making it a different legend, perhaps.
Well, the hagiography is over and the reasons are interesting. I mean, the most simple reason is that he's dead and it's much easier to write about him now in more honestly and in a more rounded way. But there are also more complicated reasons. So one review of my book said this sort of stuff about Mandela had come out at the time. Would we even have reported it?
That's an interesting thought.
And the answer is no, people did know about it and didn't report it. So for instance, just after Nelson Mandela was released from prison, you know, he was in this very strange position where he had a lot of newfound power that he'd never exercised before and was a novice at exercising power. And the question arose to him, what do I use it for? And personally, he was reeling. He, you know, the only life he knew before prison was with his wife and he wanted to fix a very damaged and broken relationship. And there were moments where he used his public power, his political power, misused his political power to try and fix his marriage. You know, he bullied people for money for a kidnapping trial. A couple of witnesses and co-defendants disappeared just before the trial and he was indirectly involved in that. And people knew about that but didn't report it because to report him doing those sort of things then would have been not just an attack on him but an attack on the South African project.
It was possible. Some people did report rather unstintingly on Winnie Mandela.
That was different. That was not an attack on the South African project, but to attack Nelson Mandela. Nobody else in the world to attack Nelson Mandela, or just to be completely honest about Nelson Mandela in the early 90s or midnight, even the late 90s, it would have just automatically by its nature being a reactionary right-wing attack on him and on a very hopeful South African project. So I think it is only really now in the last few years that it's possible really to write about him, both honestly and sympathetically. That combination wasn't possible before, which is really interesting to me.
By golly, he was human, and there were flaws, and there were successes.
Yeah, and that it wasn't possible to write that way in the 1990s. It really wasn't.
We're speaking with Johnny Steinberg, author of the new, in a sense, dual biography called Winnie and Nelson, and his subtitle is Portrait of a Marriage, and we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
And we are back with The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooks Spector, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Johnny Steinberg, author of the new dual biography, psychological portrait, really, Winnie and Nelson, which explores the nature of their lives, their relationship, and the relationship as it relates to the change in the country. I think that's probably a decent way to put it. When I think about people writing about Nelson Mandela, as we're sitting here, I've got a pile of books which are in one way or another about him in the last 2 or 3 years. I went back and I looked up. There are something like 300,000 books on Napoleon. There are at least 15,000 books on Abraham Lincoln, and I couldn't find a count on Mandela, but I'm sure there must be, the number must be in the thousands by now, if you count the world, and if you count comic books and books for children and all the rest. But yours is different in I think, a fairly fundamental way, because you're looking at the two figures, analytically and psychologically, as if what's happening now is the present. So it's not an historian looking back so much as you move forward with their events. Is that fair to say for you?
I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, the way I think the subject of the book is the marriage,
okay.
Rather than him or her or both of them, but actually the marriage. And there are two reasons for me why that's interesting. One is that they very self-consciously made their marriage into a myth. They wanted the story of their marriage to be the story of their country. They understood the power of narrative, the power of celebrity. They were both born into elites and understood intuitively what it was to be exemplary, what it was to lead people. And they, in quite an ingenious way, wanted the story of their marriage to be the story of South Africa's freedom. And it was just a beguilingly simple story. You know, he was locked in prison indefinitely in 1964. They were already famous. And the story was this beautiful capsule has been torn asunder. And the day they get back together again is the day their people are free. And so the story of their marriage is the story of their people's freedom. It's one and the same story. And they and a group of others, I mean, the most significant other being Oliver Tambo, the president of the ANC, sold that story to the world with great skill and made them the most famous couple in the world in the 1980s.
Yeah, the kind of people you could organize a music festival around and have 300,000 people show up.
Exactly. The type of couple you couldn't be against. And that was the genius of what they did with that marriage in global culture. This was the Cold War. This was a time when people chose sides. And somehow Nelson Mandela and his marriage and his wife were elevated above that. You know, to the extent that YouGov did a poll in the UK in 1988, everybody, literally everybody in Britain knew who Nelson Mandela was. It was over 90%, and 70% wanted him free, including 59% of people who voted for the Tories. So this marriage was, what happened to that marriage culturally was almost magical. It managed to breach divides. So that's one reason why the marriage is interesting as a subject of the book. But the other is, the premise of my book is that their marriage did embody their country's story, but in ways of which they lost control.
And they lost control, and the king and the queen got married, and they lived happily ever after until they didn't.
As did the South African nation, exactly. So it's so that the two move in track. So, you know, what happens, many, many things happen, but one is that they drift apart politically, and they end up having polar opposite views about how apartheid should end. For Mandela, the older he gets, the more certainly is that unless apartheid ends peacefully by negotiation, the more chances that the country will descend into chaos. What he wants to avoid above all is civil war. He doesn't think the country will ever recover from it. Winnie goes exactly the opposite way. She does not believe apartheid will properly end unless it's by a violent insurrection. and a great drama in the marriage, and it comes out in these recordings we were talking about that Kobi Kutsir stole, is that she goes to see him and plays being the loyal wife, but behind his back is organizing an armed insurrection from his home.
She's ready for the washing of the spears, and he's trying to organize it so the spears are put in a box.
Exactly. So that's one way in which the marriage does really embody the country, but in ways that they're losing control of. You know, another, and there's such an irony in this, his great, great fear is a bloodbath. His great fear is the destruction of violence. And on the one hand, he is getting more and more powerful as he becomes globally famous, but he is locked in jail and losing touch. And what he's losing touch with is the fact that everything he fears, his great nightmare, has actually white-anted its way into his very family. It's in his home in Soweto. It's in his wife.
And his children.
And his children, his daughter Zinzi. The great violence, the great destructiveness of violence that he fears is right there in the heart of the Mandela family, and he doesn't know it yet.
The snake has worked its way right into...
Precisely.
Into every room of the house, basically.
Precisely. And you talk about the book as an unfolding present. For me, the most dramatic moment in this unfolding present is Nelson Mandela's realization that the darkness, the terror that he fears is actually in his family. And he finally sees it face to face in the late 1980s.
The way you're telling it now, it sounds almost like the inevitability or the inevitability-ness, if there is such a word, that unfolds in a Greek drama, a Greek tragedy.
And interestingly enough, by the time he's out of prison, Nelson Mandela is privately talking about his life as a tragedy. It's hard to get one's head around because at this point he is triumphant. He is the most famous human being on the planet.
There's a photograph everywhere. People, you put his face on the cover of a magazine and the sales go up.
Exactly.
It's worse than the Queen.
And he is succeeding politically. He is about to deliver a majoritarian democracy to his people, amazingly, without civil war. So he is successful beyond his wildest dreams. And yet he is describing himself as a tragic figure. And what's remarkable for me about that is how cleanly he is able to separate himself as a public myth and as a human being. He's obviously happy that he's famous because it's a symptom of his political success, but he doesn't for a moment think it's a substitute for personal happiness. He understands that he was broken during those 27 years and that his family was broken. He is deeply sad about it and he's deeply angry about it. And I find the most remarkable thing about him is that never for a single moment does the fame substitute for the personal loss. He just knows that they're different things.
One of the most arresting parts of the book, and I think other people have noted it too, you quote Barbara Masakela, who was his chief of staff at the time, saying in effect that he was the saddest person she had ever met. And given the circumstances, isn't that an irony?
That comment coming from her in particular was amazing because in the early 90s, she was his chief of staff,
yeah,
and possibly also his closest friend. Or they were certainly very close. They were spending 16 hours a day together. And she describes how his staff was all women. She describes
that's true.
In front of women, he could relax a little. He could take the mask off. He was such a concealed person. And with him 16 hours a day, sort of just feeling his presence, she said there were moments where it wasn't anything he said. He just emitted this... And to quote her, a stillness, a grim stillness. And she just realized that he descended into a very dark, very sad, and very angry place. And that it happened periodically.
It was a room that he wouldn't let anybody else in.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess thinking about it, that Churchill had what he described as the black dog.
Yeah.
And his staff would sort of surround him somehow so that didn't seep out into the rest of the world because there were other battles to be fought. Yet it sometimes overtook him for days on end.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that you raised Churchill. I think an interesting difference between Churchill and Mandela is that Churchill was a depressive, you know, from early. It was part of his constitution. Whereas Nelson Mandela as a young man was wildly optimistic and exuberant.
And ebullient almost.
Exactly. That's exactly what the right word. And his sadness didn't come from childhood. It didn't come from within him. It came from his adult experience. It came from 27 years in prison he looked bluntly at what had happened to him. He didn't have illusions. He knew that those 27 years were just, destructive beyond words.
One of the other things that struck me, I've ended up in discussions about this for years, not surprisingly, given my own background. It is the long-standing question of who set him up to be arrested in Halleck. And I mean, I've had arguments with people about this. And I, among other things, I've said, yes, you can blame the CIA all you want, but they were barely a presence here at the time. This was still MI6 territory. And do you really think that the whatever passed for the CIA had more information than the local South African police who had been consistently following him for 10 years? And in your book, you repeat his own sense that no, it's probably his own fault for being at a party in which he shows up in fatigues and there are people there he's never met and everybody is talking about it. And then he drives away in a flashy car pretending to be the chauffeur for Cecil Williams, which is a bit of a heads up to anybody on a motorcycle, pretty much, I guess.
Yeah.
And talk about that a little bit.
Well, then later in the book, in one of these bug conversations with his daughter, he blames his wife. He blames Winnie.
Because she talked to somebody or she set him up or?
Well, he claims in that conversation that she had a lover who was a police informer and she told the lover and the lover told the police and she did have a lover who was a police informer. It was a scandal in the 1960s.
Yeah.
But this is one of the lessons in how tricky it is to interpret a bugged conversation among family members. I don't think that he believed or certainly didn't know that it was Winnie's fault. So I doubt whether it was. What was happening is that at that stage, he was about to divorce Winnie.
Mm.
And he was a man giving the case to the children about why he was divorcing their mother. And he laid his hands on anything he could get, including a very dubious proposition that she spilled the beans and was responsible for him being in prison. So it's a wonderful example of how you can have a bugged conversation, but what it means is incredibly tricky and not simple at all.
At one point, I actually had an argument with somebody whose scholarly circumstances I respect, who said, no, it had to be the CIA. I said, no, they were much more interested in the Congo at the time, which was their topic.
I think it's pretty straightforward. He was so careless when he was on the run. From the moment he got back across the border from Botswana to when he got arrested, he really wasn't taking care. And a previous biographer, I think, has the most, you can't know whether he's right or wrong, but I think it's the most interesting take is Tom Lodge. I mean, his take is that Mandela knew that it was inevitable that he was going to get caught at some point. It was causing him immense anxiety. And he wanted it over.
Look over your shoulder all the time is probably pretty.
He knew it was coming terrifying. And he knew it was coming. And he wanted it over and unconsciously, not consciously, but you know, almost against his own will, he became more and more careless just because he wanted it all to end.
We're talking to Johnny Steinberg, author of Winnie and Nelson, a new book, a new joint biography, a psychological portrait of two people, a marriage, and the interconnections between them and the country that changed while they were involved in that change, or central to it, perhaps, or crucial for it. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Johnny Steinberg, journalist, academic, chronicler of South Africa's change, difficulties, challenges, and his newest book is Winnie and Nelson. It says on the cover, Portrait of a Marriage, but it's a little more than just the portrait of a marriage. It's the portrait of a marriage in the midst of an enormous social upheaval in a country that both of them had enormous impact on. That leads me to another question, and one that I'm getting hints of from lots of different places. Today's generation of younger people, and this is a country that is, like most of the continent, supremely a young person's country. I think the average age in this country is under 35 now. The name Nelson Mandela, people, you know, they genuflect for a second, then they begin to go, well, maybe he didn't push as hard as he could have for a settlement that would have been fairer or more equitable. I like the way Winnie took charge of things. Is that fair? And is he fading from memory in some way? Or is it being corroded by the current circumstances of the country.
The young generation now is very disillusioned with the current order and do ask questions about the genesis of that order, and he is the father of that order. So it is natural that
all his fault.
Well, I think there are variations. Some are more subtle and some are more crude. But yes, people ask questions about the founder of a world that they're not happy with. You know, Winnie in the last years of her life, Winnie was a genius at telling stories.
Creating stories even.
Yeah. And she began retelling the story of their marriage in the last years of her life in a way that was very in tune with what was going on among young people. And essentially what she said was this, that in the many years that Nelson Mandela was away, he was cut off from the experience of being black in South Africa, that he was wrapped in cotton wool was the way that she put it, while and really drifted from the experience of his people to the extent that by the time he came out and was negotiating, he was no longer substantially their leader. And she said, whereas I embodied everything that black South Africa suffered. I was the one who was thrown in solitary confinement. I was the one who was tortured. I was in the flames of the insurrection. I faced the enemy in the flesh at close range. I knew the pain. I knew the suffering. And if I had been in charge in the early 90s, I would not have compromised. We would have fought. And for people who were not born at the time of those events, people not born when Nelson and Winnie separated, it's an intuitively powerful story.
People who urge that kind of violence or say, I would have done that kind of violence, they would have won a victory and left the place a desert.
That's my view too.
Thank you.
They were not there. They didn't see how close we came to going very, very wrong. But I don't think people like you or I saying that helps. I think there's a very powerful sense among the young that their forebears should have fought harder in the early 1990s.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was young in the United States during the Vietnam War and, you know, we were going to change the country and fix things.
Well, I mean, one should have some respect for what they're feeling and thinking, and there are questions to ask about what happened in the early 90s. I don't think it's simply, was the settlement good or was it bad, or should we have gone to war or rolled over? They're more nuanced and subtle spaces in the middle, and I think it is good to engage with critical questions about what happened in the early 90s.
I'll say something that's possibly heretical, but somewhere along the way, some part of me says it might have been better if there had been a trial or two or three of some of the most awful people so that more would have come out. There would have been a certain amount of catharsis and there would have been a way for people to say that's how it was. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission didn't exactly deliver on that promise.
I find those counterfactuals quite hard to judge. I just honestly don't know. But I suspect it wouldn't have changed a lot. You know, I think just the fact that now, 30 years after democracy, the very structure and geography of the country is not all that changed. You know, the fact that poverty is almost entirely black, the fact that there is now a massive black middle class, it's bigger than the white middle class. But if you're young and black and coming up in the world, into the professions, it still looks like a pretty white world outside of government. I think that those granular experiential things, facts about the present are overwhelming, and that it's almost inevitable that people will be asking very critical questions about the settlement of the early 90s. I'm not sure anything could have avoided that. So yes, a couple of trials would have been very powerful. But I'm not sure that would have changed people's granular experience of what's going on now.
That leads me logically to the next question, which is, are you, crudely put, are you pessimistic or are you optimistic about the fate of South Africa? Because you've written a lot about the not-so-soft underbelly, shall we say.
You know, the idea that South Africa is about to explode, the idea that it's, you know, just a couple of seconds from Armageddon is a very old idea. It's the way South Africans think and have thought since the early 20th century, if not earlier. It's an ingrained way of thinking in South Africa, and I'd be foolish to predict the future, but I'd like to think that that's never been true and never will be. Things are pretty low at the moment. Our ruling party is a shambles and a mess. Jacob Zuma's project was a nightmare. It was a kleptocratic nightmare. It was an attempt to steal the country, and the damage that it's done is obviously permanent. You know, when the idea that Cyril Ramaphosa was going to march in
solve everything.
2018 and turn the country around. I think we know now that, well, some people think another person may have done it. I think the damage is permanent, and I guess that's pessimistic. I also think that even in low moments, there's an enormous amount of creativity, and I would hazard a guess, and I hate to guess because all of us are always wrong about the future, but I would hazard a guess that in 10 years time, we will not be talking about an electricity crisis and we will not be talking about a logistics crisis, that those matters would have been solved partly by privatization. We'll still be left with the same country. It's going to be a hard and difficult country. But I do think that we would have moved on from the present, not into a rosy future, but certainly to a different future.
Well, physicist Niels Bohr and baseball player Yogi Berra both said, prediction is hard, especially about the future.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
What's your next project? I'm sure that's one of those things people always ask, and you, wait a minute, I'm not even finished dealing with this one yet. But there must be something that is starting to tick away at you, some issue, some itch that needs to be addressed somehow.
I'm actually, I hope, about halfway through the next project.
Hey, this one's been put to bed for a long time now.
Yeah, this one I finished a draft a little under 2 years ago.
Ancient history.
So I'm currently writing a book on the homosexuality of Cecil John Rhodes. It's the connection between his very private life and his public career as an imperialist, and the connections between them.
He must have been deeply in the closet.
Well, to be outed would be to have your career
that
your reputation ruined and to go to jail.
Yeah, that would have been it. Although, I mean, Oscar Wilde was outed, it didn't matter much.
Well, it killed him, literally.
Yeah, eventually. For the longest time, he was out there.
And so it caught up with him.
We're speaking with Johnny Steinberg, author of the new, in a sense, dual biography called Winnie and Nelson. And his subtitle is Portrait of a Marriage. And we'll be right back after this message.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back with The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Johnny Steinberg, author of the new dual biography, psychological portrait, really, Winnie and Nelson, which explores the nature of their lives, their relationship, and the relationship as it relates to the change in the country. I think that's probably a decent way to put it. Cecil John Rhodes, the archives are filled with stuff about him, obviously. I mean, the Cape Archive and the National Archive, everywhere you look, no doubt. But is that side of his life accessible?
Yes, if you look the right way. I'm dealing with all sorts of sources, but just to talk about one of them, there's a fascinating period. It begins in 1902 when he died, and it ends in the late 1940s when the last people who knew him well died. And in that window of 46 or so years, people began talking about him, about his intimate life in ways that they didn't when he was alive. I guess there's this kind of a gentle parallel with Mandela. The time after a great man's death is usually the best time to write honestly.
Probably safer too.
Yeah. So there were three or four biographical projects in those 46 years where biographers interviewed people who knew him, and they spoke very freely about what was going on in the world around him. And that's fascinating. And those biographies are fascinating, how those biographers found the people they did, why the people spoke. So there's kind of double layer to it. There's Cecil John Rhodes' life, and then the layers of research that reveal this.
And if you're able to prize out this truth that runs through his life.
I think so. There's a very sad story in the middle of it where in the mid-1880s, you know, Rhodes lived with another man for 4 years, and they literally did everything. You never saw one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
And this young man died tragically in his late 20s. And I think that you can piece together the fact that Rhodes never recovered from that death and was trying to resurrect this young man in the form of other young men, a series of other young men until he's dead.
And that, if you know what you're watching for and if you understand the hints and
it becomes pretty clear after a while. It's so obsessive that you can really see it. It presents itself.
And you can then say, that's the information. And this is due when you finish it.
No, it is due. Well, my formal publisher's deadlines are pretty flexible, but my formal deadline is next August, and it's slated for publication in early 2026.
Okay. And you're doing most of the research here or in Britain or everywhere?
Most of the archival material is in Rhodes's personal papers, which are in the city I happen to live in, which is Oxford.
Okay. There is a scholarship that comes to mind that's associated with him.
Yeah, there are important archives here in Kimberley and in Johannesburg. But the bulk of what I'm looking at is in
more personal side.
It's literally a 10-minute bicycle ride from my house, which is very convenient.
That's a good life. I'm going to go to work and I'll be there in 2 minutes.
Exactly.
How are you judging? I'll finish up with you, if I might. How are you judging the response that you're getting from reviewers and readers and friends as well for the current book?
I felt such excitement writing this book. I enjoyed writing this book more than any other. I was just really carried away by the hugeness of these two people.
It's not as grim in a way as some of the other ones that you've done. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, the number and Midland, it's not the kind of thing you read late at night. Let's put it that way.
Well, there's a lot of sadness in this book too.
Yeah.
But I had an energy writing this book that I hadn't experienced before. And when I pick that energy up in the responses people have to it, I'm very gratified.
And some of the reviews have taken you to task for not being as blunt, I guess, about Winnie's behavior.
I don't hold back. I think what people, and they're very particular sorts of people, are objecting to is not the information that isn't there, but they're objecting to my tone. I don't hold back at all. I think it's a pretty unflinching portrait of Winnie and what she did, both in the late 1980s and throughout her life. But the tone is not one of condemnation, which I just think would have been poor writing.
No, I didn't think you were sliding over things. I thought you were using a certain amount of, I don't want to use the word delicateness, but propriety maybe, in describing her personal and private life. It wasn't exactly unknown to people who knew her or knew of her or lived here. I mean, some of the facts were extremely well known. Mm. But what I think you did was to put not a gloss on it, but to, I hate to use this word too, contextualize these things.
And the most important context is the sweep of her whole life. I think a terrible biographical tragedy is reducing Winnie's life to what happened in 1 year in the late 1980s. I think that one needs to be unflinchingly honest about what happened in that year, but not reduce her entire 80 years to that year. It was an absolutely extraordinary life in so many ways. And I wanted each moment in that life to have its place in the sun, not just one.
Okay, I like that. Too often the films that I've seen that have been about Nelson Mandela or the two of them or just her, there's always a sense of almost an apotheosis going on. Any moment now, the stairway from heaven is going to descend and they're going to ascend upwards as opposed to a life in full.
Look, she failed as a leader in the late 1980s. She was in the middle of an insurrection. Insurrections are the most difficult moments in the world to be a leader. They require great judgments and restraints, and she had none of that. And she failed in that moment, but that is not the entirety of her story.
I think that's the right thing. A lack of restraint and a lack of a tactician, but not a strategist, perhaps.
And not even a very good tactician sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, send him off to the wrong war the wrong way and be surprised when it didn't work out and pick her confidants who unfortunately belong to the other side.
Sometimes.
Johnny, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you.
It's been a pleasure for me too.
Is there something I should have asked you that I didn't, but that you think is imperative that we make clear?
No, not at all. I'm delighted to be led by where you wanted to go. I enjoyed that very much. Thank you.
Okay. Well, for listeners who aren't quite sure what we're talking about still, new book, a joint biography, a psychological portrait, a portrait of a country, Winnie and Nelson, Portrait of a Marriage, Johnny Steinberg. It's in bookshelves now. Trust me, you will not put it down. I worked my way through a weekend with this thing dragging it from room to room in between everything else I had to do, and got right to the end of it. It is in that overused phrase, a page turner. This is Brooke Spector, and you have been listening to The Deep Dive, and today's guest was Johnny Steinberg, columnist, author, chronicler of South Africa's transition from one phase to the next, and books that have lasting quality on anybody who's interested in this country's history and circumstances. His books earn a place on your bookshelf. They're certainly on mine anyway. And with that, we'll see you again next. Well, you won't see us. You'll hear us, because this is radio. Of course it is. You'll hear us again next week, Friday morning at 9 o'clock, with another guest. We look forward to having you join us then for another edition of The Deep Dive.